My big thesis is that we no longer live in a world where both major political factions agree on the fundamentals of the system. They want to destroy liberal democracy.
The conservatives have controlled both halves of the media for at least the last decade, if not longer. Republicans are talking about what they want to talk about, and Democrats are having to respond to what the Republicans are talking about. So even if we feel like we're winning, we didn't get to talk about a million different important issues because we were so busy responding to their part of the narrative. And even if we own that part of the narrative, even if we kill them on it, we didn't get to talk about any of the stuff that we stand for. Democrats just don't have the ability sometimes to capture the media like that because they're so afraid of doing it.
He was talking about how birthright citizenship, you know, maybe we should look at birthright citizenship. You know, frankly, that, and thank you for saying that. Birthright citizenship is an important thing, and it's a liberal principle that we should be able to defend.
Well, hi, what's up?
Hi, we're live?
Yeah, we're live.
Awesome. Well, great to meet you, Destiny, or should I call you Steven?
You can call me Steven, that works.
Awesome. Okay, well, great to meet you, Steven. Thank you for having me on. I was just watching you watch me, which is always a strange experience.
Are you, how long have you been doing online content for?
Seriously, about a year.
Are you comfortable listening to your own voice and everything, or?
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty much over that at this point.
Well, that's good. Okay. I can't listen to myself or watch videos myself.
I hate watching people watch me. That's the worst thing. But I can listen to myself. I feel like I am used to editing myself, but watching people watch me, I get so focused on their reactions.
Okay, that's fair.
It still freaks me out.
Did you have, was there a particular thing you wanted to chat about or?
Well, I guess, whenever I was watching you watch me, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is you seemed to be interested in that conversation that Ross Douthat and Ezra Klein were having about like what the point of liberalism is. And I think you said that you resonated with what Ezra Klein was saying about, we want to allow, liberalism isn't necessarily about answering questions of meaning, but you also recognize that a lot of people want answers to questions of meaning. So what do you think that, how do you square that? How do you square a political philosophy that doesn't necessarily provide that with the fact that a lot of people seem to want it?
Well, I think there's a couple things at play. In terms of me vibing with what Ezra was saying, the first time I noticed this in my life was when I do debates, I'm like a very discreet fact picker kind of person. So if you want to have an argument about something, the arguments that I love the most, if somebody emails me and they're like, hey, somebody wants to have a debate on the efficacy of the mRNA vaccines and whether or not they were effective at reducing the transmission of COVID, I love debates like that. It's like, okay, well, let's, let's see what the leading papers are, see if there's any responses, look at the epidemiology, and then boom, we'll go. And then sometimes I'll get debate requests where someone will say, hey, this guy wants to debate you on whether or not America would be better as a Christian nation. I hate debates like this. Because it's like, it's such a broader thing. And one thing that's been difficult for me is realizing that most people are narratively driven, and people like me usually use that as an insult, but I don't even mean that as an insult. Like at the end of the day, like we truly are emotional like beings that have a subjective experience, and that really is the only thing that matters, Like for somebody that was a pro gamer, it would be stupid of me to say that the only thing that matters is objective reality when I literally made a living playing video games, right? So there's this gulf between me sometimes and the audiences, and that I can get lost in this very hyper discrete world of like, here's the fact, this is wrong, here's the fact, this is wrong. And I like that because I like kind of the buffet of stuff to be laid out in front of me, and then I kind of pick what I want to go forward. But I think most people like want to watch Iron Man and know that there's like a good guy and a bad guy, that there is some like virtues that we should aspire to, and in living and effecting these virtues in our life, we can have a life that looks the way that we want it to look, and there's like some end state in mind, right? Broadly speaking, your religious frameworks, a lot of your media historically, kind of resonates with these religious frameworks, and your cultural values are all they're these kind of things are all pushing forward in this direction. Okay. So laying that foundation, you asked me, can liberalism do this thing or not? Are you familiar with, do you know anything about Israel-Palestine?
I mean, a little.
A little, okay.
I've never made a video about it.
Okay, this might be kind of contentious. I'm not trying to lead you astray or say anything that's too biased or whatever, but like, there's a strong argument, I would say it's undeniable, but there was an Arab identity through like the Ottoman Empire. And once the Ottoman Empire collapsed at the end of World War One, a lot of these like countries that got drawn out by Britain and France, you know, in the West, started to kind of like try to maybe form their own identities or consider their own identities. And the Palestinian identity, I would argue, and I think it's pretty undeniable, kind of like emerged as a response to the incoming like immigrants from Europe that were Jewish, right? And because they had that thing to contrast themselves with, they started to develop a very strong, unique identity of their own that was more than just Arab, that was like a Palestinian identity. The opposite argument of this will be that these people always had an identity and I'm being racist by saying Arab, but just as like a context or framing or whatever.
Well, I mean, even another example would be European nation building. You know, the Age of Enlightenment. You know, the first, a lot of historians will say that the first modern nation state was actually revolutionary France because it claimed legitimacy from the French nation rather than directly from like a monarch, for example, which is where a lot of, governments got their from a monarch directly through God, which is where a lot of states got their legitimacy before the age of nationalism. It's a process that plays out.
I imagine. Yeah. And in the beginning, when these places form, when you have this like contrast, you have automatically, I think, kind of loaded like a story and a narrative and value in all of this. So when liberalism starts in America, and you get our constitution and we're not a monarchy, and the way that country is formed, you kind of automatically get this like story that's granted to you. And then sometimes you're lucky, you get these huge canon events, I guess, in your country's history, your world wars and everything that also give you this kind of story. But when these things are absent, I think liberalism kind of fades into this like cosmic background radiation noise that's just kind of there, and it's not enough to provide a story anymore. And then everybody starts looking around, and now you've got your mega reactionary conservatives, and like the liberals don't really have an answer because like, what am I going to say? I think we should have a country where the media is free and we vote for our leaders. Like, yeah, no shit. What do you mean? This is everything. Yeah. Who cares? Like, have, you know, say something, do something, you know? Yeah. So I think that's a big problem. One of the reasons why there's a huge problem with liberalism not having a moral character to it or some kind of like a cultural aspect to it as much as we would like it to.
I think liberals worry way too much about seeming like elitist or like we're talking down to people in a way that I mean, in some cases we do that.
Wait, real quick, just for my understanding, when I'm talking about liberalism, I mean liberalism broadly, like liberalism. Like the not like liberals, Democrats. Okay, and when you say talking down, you're speaking more on the liberal side now, politically, right?
Well, I would say that right now the right is both not liberal in the sense that, you know, they're not Democrats, and they're also not liberal in the sense that they don't support liberal democracy.
Unfortunately, I agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that the left, broadly understood in American politics, is the correct, true instantiation of liberal democracy right now. I don't really think there's another option. I think maybe at one time there was a broad consensus that liberal democracy was the legitimate kind of form of government in America. But I don't think that that's the case anymore. I think certainly the leaders on the American right, you know, the J.D. Vances of the world, the Stephen Millers of the world, you know, the philosopher type people like Curtis Yarvin or Adrian Vermeule, all these kinds of people, they openly do not like liberal democracy. J.D. Vance openly identifies as a post-liberal. You know, they, and you know, I would say that that kind of tradition is the classic American tradition. And I think at one time the right agreed with this. And I think maybe where liberals went wrong, and right now whenever I say liberal, I mean, you know, Democrats, where Democrats went wrong is they got stuck in this frame where the thing to do was to argue for technocratically correct policy suggestions in a frame where people basically agreed about the fundamentals of the system. And I think my big thesis is that we no longer live in a world where both major political factions agree on the fundamentals of the system. The right wing wants to tear it down and replace it with a reactionary post-liberal regime,
I'm totally stealing in a future debate, by the way. You keep saying post-liberal. I like when you said pre-liberal. I'm absolutely stealing that for some future debate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think they are. Yeah. I mean, if you listen to them talk, they talk about how much they hate the Enlightenment. You know, mm-hmm. the United States liberal democracy is a product of the Enlightenment. That's something that I think the left, you know, to the extent that I have criticisms of the way that the left has behaved in the last decade, I think the fact that we've distanced ourselves from that tradition is a real mistake. Mm-hmm. I think people on the academic left, especially, you know, they want to distance themselves from like the founding fathers and the founding tradition. You know, we can criticize them, but to distance ourselves from them entirely, I think, is a huge mistake, because there's so much. I mean, it's really important to the narrative of America that there's this tradition of increasing liberty and equality, and, you know, some measure of social solidarity as we go through American history. Mm-hmm. And you can find that strain going all the way back to the American founding. That's why, you know, abolitionists would cite the Declaration of Independence. That's why, you know, in the New Deal, whenever FDR was unveiling the Thomas Jefferson Memorial, he talked about both how Thomas Jefferson did not live up to his ideals and how his ideals were incredibly important for motivating, you know, the march toward greater and greater liberty and equality in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that's a strain that I think we've abandoned, and it's one that I think we should pick back up again.
I definitely agree. It's funny because there are like reverberations of this argument that are found in so many different ways, fragmented throughout my personal history. Can I ask how old you are? Or are you private about your age?
I'm 24.
Okay. Damn, Jesus. Sorry. Anytime I talk to somebody whose birthday starts with like 2000 or whatever, I have to mentally reconfigure, but that's okay. When I started debating in 2016, one of my huge complaints that I'd noticed, I don't think that everybody needs to be like a debater type or whatever, that everybody has to be willing to go out and fight and argue. Now, if you're doing media news, I have a higher expectation. But one thing that was very annoying to me was I noticed that in the spaces that I existed in 2016, I was in very radical debate spaces. So I don't know if you've ever heard of like Stefan Molyneux, back when JFK.
I was on YouTube.
In that era. So yeah. Very scary, very weird, very far right era. Yeah. And one of the things that annoyed me, in a funny way, and some of apparently a couple of my quotes have haunted me forever for this. In the worst way. Did you ever remember an Amos Yee guy? Amos Yee is how his name was spelled.
I'm not familiar with him.
Okay. Everything I'm about to say is he's a microcosm of everything. So Amos Yee was, I think, an expat from, I think, Thailand or something. And he believed that the age of consent should be zero. Literally in every sense of the word. And I listened to a bunch of people have debates with him over this. I think Blair White did. I think Lauren Chen did. I think Sargon of Akkad did. And one of the horrifying things I'd noticed when people would debate him is they would kind of have all of this like moral disgust. And then some of them could do the like, well, what if you physically injure the child? But past that, nobody really had a good argument for why you shouldn't have sexual relations with children. And I'm listening to him, like, do we not understand like anything for why this is wrong? And so I had a 2-hour conversation. It was a debate with him. We kind of argued, and I kind of gave what I would consider to be much stronger arguments for why you have like it's not just consent; it's informed consent. You have to be of a certain age. You know, there are predatory things on this side, and when somebody is, you know, dramatically outaging a person, et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of noticed when I started to debate these far right people that on a broader scale, liberals in general can defend what you're talking about, like the technocratic stuff, but they lost the ability to defend the fundamental values underlying it because they're kind of assumed. And if you were too far outside of those, people just wouldn't talk to you. So everybody can have debates on like whether or not we should or how to implement like affirmative action in some way or whatever else. But if somebody shows up and they're like, well, I think that black people are lucky to even be here, so slavery was fine. A lot of liberals are like, I don't know what to say to that. And then they just kind of like leave it to the side. And for a while that worked, but then it kind of like festered and nobody really gave any responses to any of these things. And now we're in a situation today where it's like, I don't know, but when Trump talks about, you know, certain topics related to should immigrants be here at all or what types of immigrants should we have, I think we're in a climate where we're much warmer to a very like race realist hereditary approach to immigration, although like the mainstream MAGA movement hasn't said it yet, but I think they're definitely warmed up to it. And I think that that inability for liberals to kind of defend on a fundamental moral level their principles, as opposed to just arguing the technocratic stuff, I think that was a huge mistake for them to lose that, for it to just be assumed.
I totally agree with you. A great example of this that I have been thinking about ever since it happened was, you remember the Kilmer-Abrego Garcia case, right?
I do indeed, yeah.
Sent to El Salvador.
Hard to believe that that was in the past year. Jesus Christ.
I know. Well, around that, you're familiar with the journalist Matthew Iglesias?
Yeah.
He was talking about how it was a bad idea for Democrats to make a big deal of the Kilmer-Abrego Garcia case because because Democrats at the time were polling badly on immigration, and he thought that it would raise the salience of immigration as like a topic in the public discourse, and he thought that that would be bad for Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this was a horrible. I thought this was horrible. You know, morally, I thought it was horrible because it's a bad thing that we were doing. We exiled this guy to a gulag, to a torture camp under a weird crypto dictator in El Salvador, and we should be able to say that that's wrong. So you know, just first thing, you know, we should be able to say that that's wrong from a principled moral level.
Yeah.
But also, sometimes arguing the principle, showing why something is bad, giving a really strong example of why something is bad, can help turn public opinion. You know, and that's what we saw right after the Kilmer-Abrego Garcia case, whenever Van Hollen went down to El Salvador and basically got proof of life. It made the entire thing like a media cycle mm-hmm. for like a week. And that was the first time that Trump went below 50% on immigration for his first term. And so I think sometimes pushing for the principle, I mean, you got to be smart about it, but pushing for the principle, using good examples to show why the principle that you're supporting is correct, even when it's not a majority opinion right now, that can be a strong thing to do. Another example would be this is Matthew Iglesias again. He was talking about how birthright citizenship, you know, maybe we should look at birthright citizenship, mm-hmm. basically. And, you know, frankly, that, and thank you for saying that. Birthright citizenship is an important thing, and it's a liberal principle that we should be able to defend. If you're mm-hmm. born in America, you should be an American. And I don't want to compromise on that. And I don't think that we should have public intellectuals or politicians or people leading the Democratic Party and the broad liberal movement who are willing to compromise on principles that core.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's one of the complaints I have is that politics has gotten less academic and more, if you spend a lot of time like in the influencer world, you truly can analyze almost all of politics through kind of this influencer lens now because of the attention economy and social media. And I think this is tragic. I think it's a horrible thing. But it's so funny because I would get caught up with my audience arguing over certain things a lot. And one of the big arguments we would have is, so back, I don't know how much you're aware of my debating history or whatever, but I kind of go back and forth between this, like, okay, we need to be nicer to conservatives to bring them more to the fold and to be more amenable versus I hate these motherfuckers. I just want to energize my side. Everybody over here should die. These guys are terrible people. And so like, I think last year or the year before I was on my very-
They are bad people. We should say that. They are bad
Yes,
people.
Yes, I agree. People. Yeah. When I was on my last conservative arc, you know, I was doing the whole, I did kind of like a Daily Wire circuit where I talked to Michael Knowles and Ben Shapiro and Jordan Peterson and Candace Owens. And one of these arguments that would pop up my community so much would be this, like the rhetoric. They call them, what do they call them? Optics frogs in my community, where there would be like a thing that would come up. And sometimes people become a little bit too rhetorically or optically obsessed where they're like, well, I don't know if it's okay to be so mean about this thing. I don't know if it's okay to say this. And I think there's some truth to that, right? Like if some guy comes out and says something like, I don't know if we should be teaching critical race theory at every college. I don't know if we have to come out and say, well, this person is an evil piece of shit, right? Maybe that's too much. But if I want to like lay into or go off on people that are unironically defending like the double tapping of Venezuelans that are just floating in the ocean or whatever, and be like, well, optically, I don't know if this is okay. I'm like, well, hold on. There is like a moral principle here that might be worth, you know, some kind of not just sacrificing optics for, but like pushing to create the optics. A thing that I noticed, a huge example here is Newsom and the redistricting thing. When conservative, yeah. You know, this concept of the Overton window, I feel like liberals or Democrats, they look at the Overton window as the maximum capacity threshold for political exploration, and conservatives view it as like a launching pad where,
yes,
and yeah, oh my God, because like people don't, I don't know how you're on the far left progressive, I don't care, I'm just gonna stop hedging, okay? If I say things are politically tricky or whatever. The Bernie bros get this so wrong, where the Bernie bros look at like Bernie versus Hillary and everything else, they're like, I can't believe the Democrats fucked them over, I can't believe the Democratic Party did this, this is so evil, the superdelegates and blah, blah, blah. And nobody remembers, or it seems like they don't, Trump got nothing. Trump had no help when he was running in that early primary. Everybody hated him. The establishment hated him. The media hated him. The lawmakers hated him. All the other debaters hated him. The Fox News hosts hated him. Megyn Kelly, all the comments, like everybody hated this guy. But because, you know, I would say it's almost entirely due to luck. I give this guy no credit for political instincts. He was just entertaining. Like, he managed to discover like a new thing that the conservatives were, you know, oh, I guess we like this speech. And then everything, especially since then, although I would argue, you know, from the Al Gore having the election taken from him by the Supreme Court, the McConnells taking a Supreme Court pick from us, the, you know, thing after thing after thing, I would say Republicans have always been kind of exploring. But especially as of recently, Republicans don't stop and ask, like, what can the public, you know, what can they handle? It's more just like, how far can we push to see, you know, what we can make them handle? And yeah, I think that liberals and Democrats are way too big on seeing themselves as chained down. And that, I really appreciate when Newsom did that redistricting thing. I almost didn't believe it when I first read that, because I was like, oh my God, somebody's memeing. That would be based. Imagine if California was like, well, Texas did it. Well, fuck it. We're going hard on our redistricting. And he did. And initially it was kind of like I don't know if this is going to go through or not. And it was a really good idea. And other states, surprisingly, I pushed this tit for tat idea for a while now, and people are picking up on it, and I'm sure other people have been talking about it for longer than me, but like other states, you know, started to double, you know, to stop and think. I think it was Indiana that changed their mind on like going through their redistricting. Like, finally a Democrat was like, oh, well, we're going to actually respond in kind or do some big step here and see what we could do. And yeah, I think that that's, I think that Democrats need to be more willing to say, you know, this might be a 30-40% issue right now, but morally it's so important. We can make this a 55-60% support issue. Yeah. Oh, and then on the last quick thing on that, you mentioned that birthright citizenship thing. I think it's okay to have discussions about values of the country, but not with somebody who's so fundamentally unaligned morally with your position. Like, if we want to have a conversation about affirmative action or stuff like that, or diversity, equity, inclusion, I think some of this stuff is a little bit cringe. Personally, I do, but I'm never, ever having that conversation with somebody that I know is like a bigoted racist. I'm not giving any ground to that guy, because we're not coming from the same place at all. Even if we seem to have similar policy positions, there's no common ground to be found there. It's all illusory, you know?
Well, yeah, and you know, I got a little aggressive talking about Matthew Iglesias. I really shouldn't. You know, he's a net positive
for sure
for the world. Mm-hmm. He's a net positive for the world. So Matthew Iglesias, if you're hearing this, I love you. Yeah, you would like the video I just made about Gavin Newsom, because I think this is one of the reasons why he's like constantly leading the polls whenever people are asked in 2028, like, who do you want to be the Democratic nominee? And it's because Gavin Newsom does stuff.
Yes,
you know. I think the problem that liberals have, and you talked about liberals seeing themselves confined by the Overton window, you know, what's politically possible.
Uh-huh.
I think liberals see themselves in many cases, that liberalism is the maintenance of the system. They've come to see themselves as the maintainers, the only true guardians of like the American system. And I think that lends itself to a kind of nervous status quoism that isn't attractive. But the thing is, whenever you're motivated by values rather than just this kind of more technocratic ideal, you can do things like redistrict your state in response to Texas, mm-hmm. because you're not worried about maintaining that kind of consensus that hasn't really existed since at least 2016 and probably before then. You can do things like eliminate the filibuster. You can do things like pass Supreme Court reform. You can uh-huh. do things, you know, there's so many things you can do whenever you're motivated by the actual whenever you're motivated by actual liberal values like liberty, you know, helping people live a fulfilled, self-actualized, autonomous life, and equality, you know, ensuring that people have some sort of social equality, that they're all treated equally.
Uh-huh.
Whenever you're motivated by those actual values, there's so much more you can do.
Yeah, I 1,000,000,000% agree. I like the one big thing that's hard for people to notice, and again, coming from the streamer world especially, you see this, or from economics, are you familiar with the concept of like opportunity cost? So I think that some people don't see sometimes the opportunity cost of like controlling narratives. So I read a post on this once and oh my God, it unlocked my brain so much for this. Imagine you go onto the Destiny subreddit and the top post is a guy who posts a picture of his golden retriever. And the post is something like, look at how cute and adorable my dog is. Come comment on my dog. And let's say you click into that thread and you want to type, you know, I think the dog is really cute. And imagine that like the top post or the first post that you see there is golden retrievers or whatever are the most vicious, disgusting dogs in the world. They run around eating, you know, old ladies and killing children. And you're like, okay, well, hold on. First, I'm not even going to get mad at this post. I'm going to go do some research. I'm going to respond to this post. I'm going to completely shut it down. I'm going to destroy the misinformation. I'm going to be well read on the topic. And you do it. In the best world where you're not emotionally dysregulated, where you shut that post down with all the best, you know, sources and facts in the world, like take a step back and understand like what just happened. You saw a thread, it made you feel good, and you wanted to go in and say that the guy's dog looked good. And now you just spent all this time fighting on some bullshit, and that goodness that you could have contributed to the world is gone. When people see the conservatives, they've gotten so good at this, and I hate how much good at this. They have control, and when you say this, the opinion I'm giving is like controversial with everybody because nobody wants to believe this. The right, obviously, they don't because they can't, and the left is so mindful being afraid of being even having the appearance of having TDS that they'll never say anything like this. The conservatives have controlled both halves of the media for at least the last decade, if not longer. Republicans are talking about what they want to talk about, and Democrats are having to respond to what the Republicans are talking about. So even if we feel like we're winning because we've shut down the 450 millionth comment about trans, you know, four-year-old dogs taking over schools or whatever, we're like, oh, we own that guy. Well, hold on. We didn't get to talk about any of Trump's failures. We didn't get to talk about, you know, the sending to people to CCOT. We didn't get to talk about, you know, a million different important issues because we were so busy responding to their part of the narrative. And even if we own that part of the narrative, even we, you know, kill them on it, we didn't get to talk about any of the stuff that we stand for. Like every single thing in the media is either what the conservatives stand for or a response to what the conservatives stand for. And it's such a bad approach to politics, which is like you said, even as stupid as it was, and I have to make people understand this, and it sounds bad and it sounds evil, right? Because it is part of my strategy, even though I mean, it is to some extent intentional, believe it or not. When Trump is mean to people, when Trump dehumanizes people, when Trump is an asshole, there is a power to that because it dictates what people are talking about. As stupid as that Gavin Newsom press Twitter account or whatever is, when conservatives are crying about that on Fox News, and for a while, a lot of them were, even if it seems like, well, it kind of just looks immature on our part, doesn't it? No, you don't understand. They're responding to us now. They're not talking about the 12th trans swimmer. They're not talking about an illegal immigrant that got a speeding ticket or a parking fine. They're not talking about Trump's new plan for Greenland. Now they're responding to us. And Democrats just don't have the ability sometimes to capture the media like that because they're so fucking afraid of doing it.
No, I agree. Yeah, no, this is a lot of what I talk about in the Gavin Newsom video I just put out. I mean, he represents liberal anger at the last decade personified. I think that's what Gavin Newsom is. He's unapologetically angry. And whether or not that's like genuine, you know, I think Gavin Newsom's most important position is probably that he wants to be president one day. But at the same time, he also understands better than I think basically any Democratic politician that's in the game right now, that what the Democratic primary base wants more than anything, more than, you know, any particular instantiation of ideology, they want someone that's loudly, vocally, and substantively anti-Trump.
And unapologetically, be out there and have a strong position, you know?
Yeah.
After the last election, I brought this up to so many people. After the last election, how many panels was there on? How many conversations with Ezra Klein, with every person in the media, where all the liberals were like, what did we do wrong? How do we appeal to the conservative voter? What do we have to do differently, guys? Like, were we too mean? You know, what happened? I don't know, right? And then look at the Republicans after 2020. We didn't even lose the election, and we're going to run the same guy. And we're going to do it harder than we did last time. When was the last time on Fox News you saw, you know, Sean Hannity or any of these subhuman vermin talking to each other? Like, how do we appeal to the liberal mind more? Right? It's not even a thought in their head.
Never. No, I think liberals get too caught up. On some level, liberals, I think, hate themselves a little too much. Like, we don't see ourselves, and I say we, you know, I don't think of myself this way, but I think of myself as a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Liberals think of ourselves as, like, fundamentally not the true Americans. Like, we've accepted this narrative that, like,
true.
The great heartland American is,
our
like,
Republicans,
the true,
the good old yeah. boys in their trucks with the cowboys and everything. Yeah, true.
But people that live in cities, people that are liberals, are just as American, you know? I think that it sucks that we've basically implicitly ceded American identity
mm-hmm.
to conservatives. That's something that I think is a real problem. And it's why, you know, after every election, we go like, oh my gosh, we're so out of touch with America. We're so out of touch with America. We need to go do safaris to little cafes in Iowa and figure mm-hmm. out why the rural people hate us. And it's like,
could okay. you imagine, yeah, that message the other way around? Could you imagine a liberal going, why don't any of these country come into the city and talk to us sometime? You could never even say that. Liberals would crucify you for saying
that.
You
think Fox News has ever done, like, we went on a trip to a New York City bodega to figure out why, you know, so many people vote for Democrats?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, never.
I wonder if they've ever done that.
No. They just pull videos from... There's this guy called Mark Rice, I think, and other people who do like the liberal on the street interviews where you edit them to be as stupid as possible so they don't know the answer to anything because they'll just all hate yep. America or whatever, right? Yeah. What does the yep. average liberal think? Well, we found an 18-year-old white college girl who goes to Yale, and we interviewed her, and she's the president of the Social Justice Warrior Club. And it's like, okay, yeah, thanks. Yeah, this is the average liberal. Okay, chief. Yeah,
this
so stupid.
Yeah,
I had I did a show yesterday with a guy called Harry Cole something the West. It's some program on Fox News. It probably airs in a few days. But I bring this up because whenever people bring up problems with liberal places, now rather than conceding on those, because I would, because I think I'm fair or whatever, now I fight on the other end. It's like, well, hold on. This guy, you know, he rattled off all these things. It's like, well, isn't America doing great now? And blah, blah, blah. Like, our GDP has grown so much and the stock market, you know, is still doing okay. And then I think like one or two topics later, he brings up, he's like, well, I don't know about Gavin Newsom running for president. You know, like, California's in a lot of trouble. And that's like a truism that California sucks, by the way. Like, you just are supposed to accept that. And I love pushing back on some of those truths. Like, well, hold on. What do you mean California sucks? Well, look at the problems. I was like, well, you just earlier talked about the stock market growth and GDP growth. Where do you think all that comes from? Not just California's GDP, the entire country. We're all thriving on AI and everything right now, right? There's like six companies that are making up half the gains of the S&P 500. Maybe not that dramatic, or maybe almost that dramatic. Like, this is all Silicon Valley. This isn't the good old farmers from Iowa and Arkansas, whatever else. These are tech nerds and probably a lot of trans women in fucking San Francisco. Like, that's where all these gains are coming from. How are you going to sit here and attack California for all these issues when, like, eight out of the, you know, top 15 schools in the country are all UC schools, and they, you know, the economy is huge and the opportunity is huge? Yeah, it's way too much of the liberals being desperate to win the approval. I see this in, like, oh God, and like Jake Tapper, where it's like, please, every time they open their mouth, all I hear is, please don't label me as having Trump derangement syndrome. Please don't say I have TDS. Please don't. Look at how fair I'm being. My 50th Noah, the poll guy, my 50th Noah tweet about Biden and how senile he was, the guy that Nate Silver, yeah. Oh God, it drives me crazy.
Yeah. And I think part of why this happens is because a lot of liberals don't think of themselves in terms of the values that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whenever you're thinking about yourself in terms of the values that you have, rather than the, you know, specific policy positions that you're trying to get, or rather I should say, because the policy positions are very important, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but I think they should be motivated by a deeper commitment to values. And I think whenever you're not motivated like that, it makes you insecure. It makes you maybe even subconsciously insecure. It makes you feel like you're not on as firm a footing to say, like, actually, you know, I am right. You know, actually, you know, our solution to this problem, our way of, you know, defining America,
mm-hmm.
you know, increasingly that's under question. You know, how are we going to define America? Is it going to be, you know, a nation committed to certain ideals that we all share, or is it going to be a nation where we all have to swear allegiance first and foremost to the, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants?
Mm-hmm.
Or
the evangelical WWF ceremony havers after assassinations or whatever, the whole Erica Clark. Jesus, yeah.
Yeah. But that's why I think values are so important. And I think it would really help liberals sell a better story, because it would make us seem a little less like we hate ourselves, a little more self-confident, a little more interested in something beyond, you know, scrambling for, you know, just normalcy, You know, I think liberals during the Trump era, a lot of liberals have gotten into this framing that is fundamentally conservative. And I think that's a bad position for liberals to be in, because we're not, it's not where we thrive. Liberalism is a fundamentally, and you know, people probably on the far left would disagree with this, but liberalism is a fundamentally forward-looking ideology. It's an ideology that believes in progress, you know, both individually, making people better, giving people the tools to make themselves better. That's a part of liberalism that I think is often overlooked too. But it's about making society better. It's about making people better. It's about doing all these things. And so whenever we are put in the position of just having to defend the stuff that Donald Trump is, you know, trashing or whatever, you know, it's a naturally uncomfortable position for a liberal to be in, because there's other things that we would like to do. You know, first and foremost, we don't necessarily want to, you know, protect everything about the American system. We want to change the American system to be more liberal. Mm-hmm. We want to do things to make it better. But a lot of liberals, and not completely without understanding, have been put in this position where they've had to just kind of be the defenders of the status quo, or they've found themselves in that position, maybe without even their own knowledge. And I think that's a position we need to get out of.
Yeah, one of the things that I talk about for a lot of the liberal stuff too, and I don't know if it became, if it was because if it was like a status quo thing, which I also think, I think a lot of these issues are unfortunately multivariate. Like there's just a lot of things that impact this. Like when you talk about status quo defenders, how we kind of have to, I think a big part of that that nobody talks about is the fact, because this is another truism, it's a truism that liberals like to spend and conservatives are more, you know, like responsible with the government budget. That's not true at all. That's just bullshit.
No.
Right? Or that liberals are bad for the economy and you know, help welfare, and Republicans are better. Like, that's not true at all. Right? There's that clip of Donald Trump in the 90s or whatever saying, well, I think the economy's, you know, kind of better under Democrats, you know? Like, I talked to some people, and like even things that I kind of just take for granted. I was like, you know, the last budget surplus was under Bill Clinton, right? Like Doge and the One Big Beautiful Bill. Like, none of these things are cutting any part of it. Even the fact that the Cato Institute just did a huge like three-part write-up on the border and everything. Even the fact that like Trump is good on the border is not really that true. Like, his third year saw more illegal immigrants crossing than the entire last term of Obama, but like COVID obviously saved him there. COVID, sometimes they talk about it when it comes to immigration, other times they never talk about it when it comes to his economy. But yeah, you run into this issue where a big thing that I try to stress to liberals is like people defend liberal values as like these very lame and lofty responsibilities rather than like these opportunities for really cool things. Like when it comes to stuff like diversity, I think this is a really big one. Like when you hear diversity, oh, you have to okay, what do I need to do? What words am I not allowed to say? Like, what the fuck do, you know, what, you have to figure this out. And it's like, that's not really the case. Like, we have a lot of really awesome stuff in this country. I have a lot of awesome people in my community. I've been in a lot of awesome podcasts with a huge diversity of different people. And that, like literal actual melting pot of all the different people that can come to the United States and do all the crazy shit here, whether we're talking on, like, an entertainment level, you know, all these British people that sneak in here with their American accents and act for us, or we're talking about on a tech level where South Africa, can white people like Elon Musk come in and set up, you know, revolutionary companies like SpaceX and Tesla. These are like cool opportunities that the United States is uniquely positioned to take advantage of. But whenever we talk about all the cool things that liberalism has to offer, it feels like we treat them as like shackles or burdens sometimes, instead of talking about them, I think, in a little bit more of a positive light, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of liberals are so afraid of being seen as like elitist. You know, we're afraid to talk about the positive virtues of these things for the same reason that we're afraid to talk about ourselves as being, you know, fundamentally as American as the people in the Iowa diner. Mm-hmm. You know, we're afraid of being seen as like out of touch elitists. But, you know, the truth is, if we have values and ideas that we think are better, we're not going to sell them by pretending that they suck, you know, by talking about like, oh, well, actually, you know, this kind of sucks. And, you know, that no one likes that. You know, if we're going to defend the idea of pluralism, you know, the idea that a lot of different people, you know, there's a defense of pluralism in the Federalist Papers where they talk about, I forget which one it is now, my government teacher would kill me. But, you know, they talk about having a big country, because the reasoning at the time, or one of the popular thoughts at the time, was having a big republic made up of all different kinds of people would be like bad, because it would be too fractious. There would be too many different kinds of people fighting. And one of the Federalist Papers makes the argument that actually, you know, having a big republic filled with all different kinds of people can make things better, because you can get, you know, there's more opportunity to have better people rise to the top. the different faction, you know, there's going to be less chance for one faction to overpower another faction. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all these advantages to pluralism, and liberals, you know, and I would count the founding fathers generally as liberals. They would make positive arguments for these things. They would make positive arguments for them. They wouldn't just be like, oh, well, actually, maybe, you know, maybe everything kind of sucks, and maybe liberals are, you know, doing that kind of thing. You know, it sucks. There's a fun quote from The West Wing, that canon liberal show, where one of the characters is like, I'm tired of working for people who make me think that I should be ashamed to believe what I believe. I'm tired of helping them get elected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I feel about a lot of institutional liberals right now. It's like they think that they should be ashamed to believe what they believe.
Yeah, you're constantly trying to make concessions to the other side. And like, I think to some extent, like, you should be responsible for your messaging. You should be aware. You don't want to sound like an out of touch dick. Like, I mean, like, maybe an example of this might be kind of like the whole like learn to code thing. You know, like, maybe we shouldn't, you know, like, just expect everybody to be able to move on to exactly the lifestyle that we might prescribe for somebody, you know, in a city or whatever. But my God, the positive messaging just needs to be way, way, way stronger. Like, we need to have figures that we can get excited about, that we can feel happy about. And they're finally starting to pop up. It's taken a while, but like, they're starting to pop up. I don't know where you're at on the political spectrum. I describe myself as like very solidly center left. I don't even describe myself as sock dem anymore, unfortunately, because I feel like everybody that says they're a sock dem is really just a socialist or a dem sock in disguise, and all dem socks become communists or tankists or whatever. But regardless of that, I love Mamdani. I love the way he speaks. I love his messaging. I love that even though some of his policies I think are to the left of me, I like that he wants to try them, and he's got like a realistic way to implement them, because if they fail, I can point to their failures. If they work, I'll change my mind on them. I love Newsom. I love how positive and strong Newsom's messaging has been. I just saw an Ilhan Omar tweet like an hour ago where somebody was like, why didn't you even run away or whatever? And she was like, because, you know, my honor and integrity are more important to me because I have a spine, unlike you cowards. And I was like, damn. Yeah, we need more of these types. Crockett, I love her. There is some woman next to in one of the Senate committees who every time this guy talks, she's always like, mm-hmm, I like her. I don't know if you know who I'm talking about, but I see this person. She's always next to... is it Rask? I don't remember. I don't know who she is.
I don't know.
But they're awesome. Yeah, we need more of these types of people. Because, yeah, we need to... I had this arc where in 2016, I was the person. I was like the, oh my God, I can't believe Trump won. I hate this. And then over the next 4 years, I kind of had this feeling. I was like, okay, I think I'm maybe like... maybe I fell into a little bit of the kind of the Trump derangement syndrome. I'm going to like be a little bit more reasonable and try to, you know, both sides of this understanding a little bit more what's going on. I had a big debate with another content creator, Pisco, and he was trying to convince me that like, Donald Trump led an insurrection on January 6th. I think this is in 2022. And I'm like, okay, this is like peak TDS or whatever. And I completely 180'd on that. And then I start going back and I start looking at the first 4 years and I'm like, man, this Zelensky stuff was actually really crazy. And all this other, you know, the whole thing with January, all this is really crazy. I'm like, wait, this is actually so much worse than I thought it was when I thought I had TDS. Like, it's actually like the person, the girl screaming or whatever, was so much more right than I could have ever realized. But yeah, I don't know why liberals get into that mind state of like, oh, I have to be embarrassed and shy about my political beliefs and constantly make concessions to the other side when the right never has that pressure. Oh my God.
No, you can be forthrightly for something without being condescending. I think whenever I say we're too afraid of being seen as elitist or condescending, that doesn't mean I think that we should be elitist or condescending.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we're so afraid of it that we think that making a forthright defense of our ideals is going to seem condescending or elitist, or we've internalized that idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, just take a look at Bernie Sanders, I wouldn't call him a liberal, but, you know, he's forthrightly for something, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Mamdani is another example. He's forthrightly for something. You know, Gavin Newsom, you know, these guys are, they're forthrightly for something. Well, Gavin Newsom can be a little condescending, but that's sort of part of his bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't have to be like actually talking down to people, but we've internalized it that having like a strong position is going to make like, you know, red America think that we're talking down to them. And I just don't think that that's true. I think you can have a strong position without being condescending.
Yeah, and,
I think people appreciate a strong position sometimes. You know, if you think you're right, say you're right. you know, don't just be this sort of mealy mouth, like, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say you're right and defend your position. I don't think people respect the cowardice. I think people respect the strength to defend your ideals.
Yeah, because like I would even have to remind people that that's not like a good trait sometimes. People see it as a good trait, but people would always say that about Trump. They would say, "Well, I like that he speaks his mind," and it's like, "Well, that's not necessarily a good thing, right? Like, what if they are speaking their mind on things that are genuinely abhorrent?" Because nobody would do any analysis past that. They just go, "Oh, I like that he's honest." Like, what if he was honest about wanting to kill you? Like, do we really not? Or do we just stop there? So yeah, I agree that having a stronger position on things is important. I think also like. The way that you respond to things and how seriously you take things, it's so stupid, and I hate this is the case. But now, especially when media is just full of a bunch of amateurs and a bunch of losers, the demeanor on things is so important. Like, if I remember for a Jubilee debate I did, I think some woman accused me of being sexist, or she asked me if I hated women or something, and I said, yeah, half the time I do, and then I just moved on with it, because it's such an unserious thing. But I feel like every time, like, I feel like if you respond to something, and you, like, you know it's not serious, you just move on from it, and you, like, the other person sees, like, okay, I guess this doesn't work, then they move on to the next thing, too. But, like, if somebody makes this accusation against you, where it's like, you want all children to be trans, and you spend the next, like, 3 weeks talking to your constituents about how you really don't want all children to be trans, like, what a stupid thing to get caught up on. Like, why are we arguing about this again? Why are we having the 50 millionth conversation again? Like, I feel like, God, the trans issues piss me off so much. Like, I think this White House has probably had, with the whole Epstein stuff, more pedophiles inside of it. And then with the whole, how many different times there's been 50 little, like, 12-year-old girls running around Trump because he's saving women in the United States somehow, while also simultaneously championing the revocation of your right to have an abortion in, like, half the country. And I'm like, oh, God, it's so stupid. Yeah, I'm...
Have you seen the parties that they have at Mar-a-Lago? Have you seen those pictures and photo, like, the videos of the parties that they have at Mar-a-Lago?
No, the only pictures I've seen at Mar-a-Lago are with the secret classified documents strewn all over the floor. But,
oh, shit. Yeah, well, I mean, they have these, like, decadent parties. I saw one that, you know, they've got, like, they threw, like, a Great Gatsby-style party.
Okay.
Earlier in 2025. And I'm just thinking, like, these are bad people, man.
Yeah.
I mean, these are bad people. I mean, I don't think that we should be afraid to say that either. I think sometimes this is another thing that I think liberals need to get a little more comfortable doing. Just say that these are bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
These are not good people. They don't live good lives.
No.
Elon Musk is destroying himself with, like, drugs. I mean, that's, like, pretty well known. A lot of the right-wing guys don't live very good lives.
Can you imagine the same party? I know you weren't, I don't know if you were alive, I guess you weren't for it, but, like, the Monica Lewinsky stuff for Clinton, I remember my mom crying about how horrible this was. Imagine the hand-wringing on the Monica Lewinsky stuff. And Republicans now will tell you, well, it's because he led her to bullshit. It was because he cheated on his wife. And that's why everybody was so mad on the Republican side. And now that same party, like, defends, like, the Tate brothers? Defends Donald Trump, a porn star, like, 2 months after his wife just gave birth to a kid? That's insane to me. Could you imagine, not just for the racial aspect, but because he's a Democrat, too, if Obama's personal life was anything less than perfect, how much he would have been raked over the coals for that? That's crazy to me.
Yeah, and I think, but liberals have gotten, I think liberals are too uncomfortable because we don't want to be judgmental. We're too afraid of being judgmental. We don't want to be seen as, like, telling people how to live their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's important to tell people, you know, if someone comes, and there's a lot of people that are asking, you know, for advice on how to live life. And the answers that they're getting are from, you know, the trad Christian people who are trying to prepare people for a life that never really existed.
Yeah.
It only existed in, like, advertisements from the 50s.
Who are all doing cocaine every weekend, who are all cheating on their wives. Half of them are apparently gay.
Or the manosphere guys.
10 of them. Yeah. 10% of them are kids. Yeah. Jesus. Yeah.
That clavicular guy talks about doing drugs to be more lean. He's going to kill himself.
Guy's been on gear since he's 14, I think. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
We can say that that's not a good way to live life. And we can say, you know, liberalism wants to give you the freedom to pursue real freedom, by the way, you know, not just the idea of freedom. Too long, I think, you know, the freedom to pursue life as you want it has been the preserve of, you know, just people that could afford it. I mean, I think we should endeavor to make real freedom available to people. But, you know, liberalism wants to give you the ability to pursue more than just the slop pleasures. You know, that this is one of the things that I talked about in that video that you watched. You know, a lot of the right wing is, like, an appeal to basically pig-like behavior, like low pleasure, you know, just like, I mean, oh gosh, who was all at that that party that they had. I saw it all over like social media where they went to some club in Miami and played the Kanye song.
I don't know whose stream it was, but I mean, you're talking about when Sneeko, song, but when Sneeko and Fuentes and the Tates and Clavicular.
Yeah, yeah. And this is like the lifestyle that that they're selling to millions of, you know, predominantly young men who are looking for a way to live. And it's a horrible way to live. It's a terrible way to live. It's not a life that's going to lead you anywhere happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, liberals need to be more comfortable saying that.
Yeah.
These guys are bad people. They live bad lives.
They do.
It's not condescending or pretentious to say that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think.
Especially when these guys are like the ones who are constantly talking about some cultures are objectively superior to other cultures or whatever. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I wish it was obvious how like transparent, like how many different minority groups have we hopped between for them to try to find some new enemy, from the Haitians eating the cats and dogs. The J.D. Vance admitted, basically, you know, hey, if I got to make up a story to get people to care about shit, then I'll do it, to the calling. I'm sorry, somebody who's like somewhat familiar with like European immigration issues with like radical Islam and stuff. And I do think there's some stuff that should be spoken about there. For people in the U.S. to point to like Mamdani as just like radical Islamist, I'm like, you guys are crazy. To see them try to, now the whole Somali thing, apparently every single fraud in the world is now, you know, can be traced back to 80,000 people in Minnesota or Minneapolis. It's just so transparent. And for these people, I've always said the worst thing about the Trump terms is going to be debating these guys in 2028. I'm going to lose it. I don't know if I can do it because it's going to be so much hypocrisy. Like, you guys talked about George Soros for how long? I'm still waiting for my Soros check. I don't know what the fuck this guy ever funded. I'm sure he did something. Seriously.
Someone give me a Soros check.
Meanwhile, Elon Musk, the richest guy in the world, buys the number one news social media platform and overtly supports Trump for president of the United States. And crickets. I'm like, are you serious? Or you've got like, this is the party of conspiracy theories and foreign intervention. Now suddenly can't say anything about Russia. Now suddenly has no interest in the Epstein files. Now suddenly has no interest in the most conspiratorial, like weirdo administration in the history of all of U.S. presidencies. Like, give me a break.
Yeah, no one talks like that, but we should, because it's true.
Yeah.
That's absolutely it. I mean, I think, you hit the nail on the head with that one.
Can I ask a question? I'm curious, because this is my big thing right now. And the Democratic Party, I don't think anybody's near this position. Maybe Newsom is like on the lowest level of acceptability. I think that if we win the House and the Senate, and if we win the presidency in 2028, I don't think that's enough. I feel like there needs to be like a mass accountability. I don't know how, but like, I think that there has to be some way to bring us back from this cliff so that Republicans don't think that the behavior over the past decade is acceptable and can be explored again in the future. Do you think there's any future? Like, what would that even look like?
Well, I think the big failure of the Biden administration was not doing that then, to the extent that it was possible. But I think,
I agree with you there. Like, I'm like, why wasn't Jack Smith need to be here day one? Okay. I do like the idea though, that we have some moral high ground where we can say, unironically, the meme, like, Biden was the nice choice. Like, regardless of how Republicans frame him, this was the nicest motherfucker that you could have gotten. So anytime they're like, well, you guys are being so aggressive. And it's like, bro, Biden, there was not a single Antifa assassin, radical person who ever had a Biden bumper sticker. Okay. This was the nicest guy we could have put out. You shat all over him. You destroyed him. You went after his family. You did everything. So fuck you. Okay. Now it's President Jack Smith. Okay. Fuck you. So I'm glad at least we tried it. I do agree with you though. I'm like, Merrick Garland should have been way harder.
I get what you mean. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there needs to be serious talk about putting regulations or, you know, passing laws to make it so people like Elon Musk can't buy social media companies and turn them into propaganda arms of the Republican Party. I think we need to talk about the influence of money in politics. I mean, I know that that's like a phrase that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But I think it's undeniable that the Trump administration right now is propped up by rich people, propped up by people who are trying to do in the United States kind of like what they do in like Russia or Hungary or any of these other countries where there really isn't a difference between the commanding heights of the economy, mm-hmm. even though they're technically private, and the state, you know, because they all answer to the state ultimately. I mean, I think we need to pass laws that make that kind of thing impossible to do, and we need to probably throw some people in jail.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to be possible. But I mean, I think that frankly, Trump should have been in jail. I mean, he should have been in jail. It's a mistake. I think it's a mistake that we didn't do it. The president, there's a long tradition in the United States of the president not being able to be punished for anything. And it's been a horrible one. It started with a big example of this was with, you know, Richard Nixon. You know, we got this idea that we can't punish the president for anything because it's too divisive. I think all that did was just put off the problem for another generation.
Potentially,
The presidency itself needs to be reined in. The presidency, there's this whole meme that the conservative side does where they talk about how the president is the most democratic branch of government. And this is another thing that we cede to them for no reason.
If they say that, they only say that after Trump won the popular vote, because prior to that, every Republican debater that I went up against was, we don't live in a democracy. We actually live in a constitutional republic or whatever. but after Trump won the popular vote, oh man, now the president is like the most. Yeah, but yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, go ahead.
But you can take the hypocrisy for baseline. But, you know, you hear people like Stephen Miller talking about how Trump has, you know, this unique mandate of the people. And that's why, you know, he really doesn't have to listen to Congress. He really doesn't have to listen to the courts because he has this unique mandate from the people. And it's just not true. The most representative branch of government is Congress. Congress, unlike the presidency, contains representatives from the entire nation, even people that aren't in the majority. You know, even whenever the Democrats aren't in charge, you know, even whenever they aren't in the majority, they're still represented on committees. They still have the right to speak. Mm-hmm. That's just not the case for the presidency. That's sort of a wonkish thing, but I hate it when that's implicitly conceded, because I think the presidency as a concept, as an institution, needs to be dramatically reined in. I don't think that it is possible for us to continue in this situation where the president is so powerful and Congress is just so unable to do anything. I think eliminating the filibuster is important there as well to make Congress able to do stuff.
Possibly, yeah. I think that when I look at the presidency and the Supreme Court, one thing that I kind of wonder, so this is like a thing that I go back and forth on, is like, you're aware that to some extent you can't make rules for rule breakers, right? So for instance, let's say somebody, like if you play Monopoly with me and I show up and I stab you to death because I land on your hotels too many times, you're not thinking like, okay, well, for the next iteration of Monopoly, I'm gonna have a rule in the book that says no bringing knives to the game, right? Like, cause it's like, okay, well, this person clearly is not playing within any concept of a rule book, right? So it's hard for people that want to just break rules. Like, I don't know how you would bound them with rules, especially when everything they do is dripping with pretext. Like, they're comfortable now. We've seen, this is the most blatant lying that I've ever seen in my entire life from public officials. Kristi Noem and Donald Trump talking about Renee Good, talking about Ryan Pretty is just insane to me. So I don't even know in terms of what the bounding with rules will look like there. But I also think another thing that's happened is I think that in some ways America has become so divided that when you look at it like an inactive or ineffective Congress, I think that Congress is actually, it's not like a byproduct or an artifact of like bad design. I think it's actually accurately representing the fact that we are torn down the middle right now in two totally different directions. And because the Congress has become so ineffective as a result of that, we're looking kind of like to the Supreme Court and the president for legislation, unfortunately.
I think that that's true, but I think the design amplifies it. I think that the fact that you need 60 votes to do anything of substance you need 60 votes in the Senate to do anything of substance through Congress.
Sure.
Basically means that you're always going to be depending on the president and the Supreme Court to do things.
A little, Well, Biden got legislation passed. He got big stuff passed.
Yeah, but it's not going to be the kind of legislation that was passed before the two-track system for the filibuster was introduced. I mean, you can look at the kind of legislation that was passed before the two-track system was introduced, I think, in the 70s. And it was much, I mean, you would occasionally get substantive stuff through because someone actually had to stand there and talk if they wanted to filibuster.
I do think we should bring that back, and that would also help to lower the age. If you want to filibuster, you got to stand there and do it, and if you die, you die.
I think, so I agree with you. It's accurately representing that the country's divided right now, but I think that it need not be the case that that means that the president just has to do everything, and the things that the president can't do, the Supreme Court has to do. Mm-hmm. I think that Congress could do things if, you know, Congress could do things with the majority. They just can't right now, and that's an artifact of Senate rules. It could actually, ironically, be changed with a majority.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, man, there's a YouTube video I watched yesterday. I don't know the name of the guy. Does anybody remember? I watched a guy talk about, he opened talking about, it was like some Civil War battles, and then it was kind of on the same vein that we're talking about, that sometimes Democrats are a little bit afraid to be brave. I think that sometimes Democrats are afraid to do things. I've completely lost this fear now.
McClellan problem.
Well, yes.
Jamel Bowie.
Oh, yeah.
I love him.
Did you link? Oh, did you send me this? Or maybe this was sent because of you? Or yes, but wait, are you talking?
Not,
is this like a black professor guy?
Yeah, he's a New York Times columnist.
Oh, I thought he was a professor. Okay, yeah.
He might be as well.
That he's a professor look to me, but maybe it's all the books in the background. But I agree 100%. And also, I'm fearless. Like if somebody, I have a friend or had a friend, or I may have a friend, I don't know. There's a guy called, do you know who Pondering Politics is?
I'm aware of Pondering Politics.
He pushes a lot for like Supreme Court reform or packing or abolishing the filibuster. And I would say even like a year and a half ago, I was kind of one of the, well, if we do this, then they're going to do that. If we do this, then they're going to do that. And I think that was a fundamental flaw in my thinking that Republicans are bounded by what Democrats do, but they're really not. They're really just bounded by their current ambitions and like what they think negative responses will be in the future. And as scared as I am of like, I don't know if we should pack the courts, like who knows how they'll respond, like if Republicans thought it to be advantageous to pack the courts, they would do it. If Republicans thought it to be advantageous to get rid of the filibuster, they would do it. The only reason they didn't last time when Trump was pushing for it because they were worried that Democrats were going to get them on legislation come next presidential term. So I think we should take more aggressive steps. I have a lot of ideas about, like, I think the Supreme Court should be pretty radically expanded and changed a bit, and I think getting rid of the filibuster, I'm warm to the idea now. The current state of affairs, though, oh God, it's so bad in so many different ways. I can't believe Republicans just gave up all their power. Can you imagine being that cucked? You're so proud to be a representative and you go to work every day and you're like, oh, I'm not doing anything today either because I guess my job just doesn't matter because the president doesn't even acknowledge we exist.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's exactly right. It's funny. I actually called my congressman and I said that exact same thing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, not in that exact language, but at the beginning of the Trump, second Trump term, I was so mad. I called and I was like, why did you even do this job?
Yeah. What do you
act like this?
Oh, because you had to join Mike Johnson's votes or whatever to make sure you guys aren't voting in your new, or seating your new democratically elected guy.
You know, my previous congresswoman, she was literally in memory care.
Mm-hmm. Jesus.
She was literally in memory care, and the only reason she resigned is because someone found her wandering around town. And I don't say that to be glib.
Wait, this is your federal congressperson or state?
She was. She was forced to retire because people found her wandering around town.
Wait, who? Which congressperson was this?
Oh, gosh. What was her name? I've already forgotten.
This was for the U.S. Congress, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, damn. Well, not Feinstein, who died... I think,
no.
Right? And not, no. I can't believe RBG didn't retire.
Oh, Kay Granger. Kay Granger.
Kay Granger,
her
okay.
Her name was Kay Granger.
Gotcha.
Yeah, she was, she basically was found wandering around town. And that's why she was kind of forced to retire.
Damn.
And so basically, anyway, all that to say, you know, the Congress people have been turned into this just like supplicant, you know, useless branch. Mm-hmm. The Republicans deserve a lot of hate for the way that they've just kowtowed to the Trump administration.
For sure.
I think. But yeah, Jamel Bowie, I think that's how you say his name, is a fantastic columnist. He has a really great article that he wrote last year in the New York Times called They Don't Want to Live in Lincoln's America.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the best opinion pieces that I read last year. So I'd recommend checking out his stuff.
Okay, will do.
Really good guy.
Do you think that, do you think Ezra Klein is on too much of a friendly conservative arc right now, or do you think his position and everything is good? I only say this because I watched this talk with Ben Shapiro and I was losing it. Oh my God.
Yeah, I think Ezra Klein, there's a reason why I used him as the kind of archetypal example of like a consensus liberal in my video. And it's because I think, you know, he is convinced that the way to bring America back is to like maintain the overlapping Rawlsian consensus. And I think he thinks that he can do that by kind of appealing to conservatives.
Frankly. Yeah.
I don't know if that's possible. And I don't think that that's the appropriate approach for politics either.
I think the kind of the joke in my community, and then the way that I view him is that he's like 1 or 2 years behind kind of where my journey was in terms of dealing with conservatives, where it's like, we just need to be a little bit more understanding, a little bit nicer. And then we kind of will have this like alignment of values. One of the things that's been really hard for me, and I think it's really hard for a lot of people to navigate this space politically right now, we have as human beings ontologically reciprocate to each other, like empathy and treatment. Like it's a necessary precondition of being human. All of our civilization, all of society, whether you're talking about tribes of humans wandering in forests as hunter-gatherers, whether you're talking about monarchies, any form of government, like it relies on some semblance of reciprocated understanding and values. And the current conservative movement just has none. And it feels very alien to navigate that space. And when you start to see them for what they are, it feels weird to talk to other people about it because you really do sound crazy. And it's hard, but I feel like more and more people are starting to wake up to the idea that like, wait a second, these guys have no values. And that's just a very scary world. I remember I've joked about this a lot with my community. I don't know if it was like a year or a year and a half ago. It was a random comment on some thread on my subreddit where I don't remember what Republicans were cheering for. It was some stupid thing. And some guy posted, it was a top level comment. He's like, remember they'll cheer for, or they'll support the gallows or whatever, or they'll support the gallows. And I read that and I was like, I don't know what they wouldn't support actually. And then my framing on a lot of things kind of shifted from like, well, what are they supporting now? I don't care about that. What do I think they wouldn't support in the future? And when I started to think more of it in that lens, and then I see how much stuff Trump has changed, like the Second Amendment comments, like related to the Preddy stuff, like it sounded like a lip talking about guns when I'm listening to Christy Noem be like, he brought 2 magazines. He was going to be a mass murderer.
Have a gun. I don't like it that he
had a gun. Semi-automatic gun. Yeah, he shouldn't have showed up with a gun. I'm still waiting. Maybe it won't happen. I was still waiting for the term assault pistol to be dropped. I haven't heard it yet from the Republicans. like, it's just crazy to me. Like, remember the president of no new wars? And then he's bombed like 9 countries in a year. And it's just like, everything can change so quickly. And there has to be, there's no limiting principle on any of it.
It's because they hate liberals.
Yeah, some of it is. Yeah. Yeah.
They hate them and they want to destroy liberal democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if Trump is like cognizant enough to know.
He's not.
You know, exactly. But, you know, that's what Stephen Miller and J.D. Vance wanted.
They are, absolutely.
I mean, they want to destroy liberal democracy. They want to replace it with this reactionary, backwards, pre-liberal form of government.
Yeah.
That's what they want to do. And so they hate liberals because they see them as enemies. And so you, on some level, you can't convince those people.
Uh-huh.
Those people are your political enemies. You know, that doesn't mean that we should write off every Republican. But the leaders like Stephen Miller and J.D. Vance, the ones who are openly talking about how much they hate, you know, liberal democracy, those people just need to be defeated.
Vance's
American politics.
That speech that Vance gave in Europe, I don't even remember what it was for. It was like 8 or 9 months ago. That was insanity.
Which one?
Fuck, what was, I don't remember what forum this was, but he was talking about how like none of the European countries have freedom of speech like America or whatever. Was it was like a security conference or something? People are saying NATO summit.
I don't know.
It was something in Munich.
Maybe so.
The Munich conference. Yeah. Oh my God. The American political leadership right now is they're in a different world. They're in a, yeah, it's not good. Like you say, like political enemies, like it was supposed to be that there's some level of political showmanship, but then, you know, once the cameras are off, they go back to their offices and they, you know, hammer out something together. It's like, okay, well, what are we willing to give? How are we going to make this legislation work? But now like the show has become everything. Like what you see on cameras is what's happening behind the scenes. There is no, like, well, we're fighting now and then we're going to work together later. There is no working together. It's just, and also for all these people, okay, this is my last example because there's a billion of these. I'm sure the both of us could talk about. For all these people so obsessed with the deep state, I don't ever let people say they or them anymore when they talk to me. I'm like, when you say they or them, excuse me, who the fuck are you referring to? Who the fuck was the deep state for Biden? You said Biden wasn't running? Who the fuck was running the government then? I saw Biden walk out on stage and explain the executive orders that he was going to sign, why he was going to sign them, and then sign them. He spoke slow, and he definitely flubbed his words, especially, and he got slower for sure as he got older. Donald Trump doesn't even know what the fuck he's signing half the time. These people are openly, they bring it out to him, they explain what it is, and they say, oh, it sounds like a good idea, and then he signs it. Who's writing these? Yeah. You would never accept this under Biden. And like, talk about deep state. Where does all of his influence come from? Is it all like whispered through Miller, or does some of this come from like the Vance faction? Or I don't even know the different factions right now that are competing behind the scenes for Trump's brain. Jesus.
It's interesting. I made a video not too long ago about national conservatism. Are you familiar with that? You know, ideology.
I don't think so. I haven't heard the term before. No. What is that?
So the national conservatives, there's this big conference that all the big like J.D. Vance, Stephen Miller type people speak at, called the National Conservative Conference. And it's run by this guy called Yoram Hazony. Mm-hmm. And so I made a video about Yoram Hazony's interviews with like Ezra Klein and others. You know, I talked about Yoram Hazony, and his idea is that we fundamentally live in a world where everything is divided, where the nation arises from like the emanations of these blood loyalty groups that we're all born into. You know, so we're born into families, and these families have like relationships with related families, and we call these, you know, tribes, and then the tribes form together into clans, and then the clans form together into the nation.
Okay.
And so, you know, he has this whole idea about, you know, this is how he justifies a world where he calls it a primary culture dominates America. And whenever he says primary culture, he means Anglo Protestants with some room for Jewish people and Catholics, because he himself is Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to hear him talk, because I think that that is totally delusional. I have never conceived of my relationship with the American nation as being somehow mediated through my family. Mm-hmm. Ever. I've never that's not what the Constitution says, you know. It says I've never conceived of my relationship with the American nation like that. But this guy is incredibly influential on people like J.D. Vance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he openly talks about how much he's an influence on J.D. Vance. In one of those podcasts, he talked about how he has like regular private conversations with J.D. Vance. And all the people that are like the most right-wing theorists in the Trump administration, they go to the National Conservative Conference and they speak at it. He's been having some trouble lately because he is really opposed to anti-Semitism. But of course, all of these types of guys have been playing really nice with the anti-Semitic factions on the American right. And so he's been trying to square the circle of how you can have right-wing populist nationalism without anti-Semitism. And so the video I made was basically saying, you know, you can't. This is a delusion that you're having. It's a delusion to expect there to be a right-wing populist nationalism that can exist without people like Nick Fuentes or Tucker Carlson or Candace Owens. Mm-hmm. They are an inherent and inalienable part of the right-wing populist nationalist ecosystem. And so I think that I'm bringing all this back around to say, I think that there's a bit of a tendency on the American right wing to take theorists who make it their business to try and synthesize a reasonable, respectable sounding version of MAGA to the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
We take these people a little too serious.
Yes. Yeah.
Because really their ideas are not what is motivating the mass of the MAGA movement. It's people like Candace Owens. It's people like Tucker Carlson, you know, Nick Fuentes. I mean, he's probably not a big influence on the boomers, but he's a big influence on young people. It's people like this that are influencing the MAGA movement. National conservatism, all of these ideologies that were put up, you know, post facto to try and justify why everyone had to be a serf for the Republican Party, these aren't what are motivating Republicans. And I think sometimes we take it a little too serious. obviously, whatever.
For sure.
People that make it, yeah.
And if you listen to any of these guys speak for more than 10 seconds, like, it is, as much as I disagree with them, like, at least Curtis Yarvin kind of sort of sounds like he has some kind of political philosophy. I can respect ideologically driven people like Steve Bannon or whatever. When I listen to like the techno people, like when I listen to that Mark, like that Mark Andreessen guy talk, I have to unload all my pistols behind me because I'm going to just blow my brains out for how stupid these people are and how smart they think they are. They're like getting high off their own farts every time they open their mouth, like the Lex Friedmans, the Elon Musks, every time they talk about politics. I'm like, oh my God, where it's like, well, I made a Python script once and I have a tech company now, so I've solved all of politics. All of political theory is beneath me and I understand exactly how the world works. It's like, oh my God, it's so cringe and stupid that these people are as politically aligned as they are. Yeah. I also like the meme of, especially with Asmongold, just in terms of what you were saying, for how they're trying to define, like, well, the family structure and this is where nations come from. And it's like, what was the picture? It's a picture of Asmongold, a comic drawn poorly, obviously. And it's like constantly criticizes inferior races, also wants like the politics, or also has the politics of like an African warlord or whatever, because these guys, when they speak about what their ideal political system is, it sounds like the most devolved form of human existence possible. They're like, we should execute every single rapist and every single we should murder every single one of these people, and we should have no tolerance for pornography and abortions, and women shouldn't be allowed to maybe even vote again. And it's like, okay. So,
well, this is what happens whenever you base your entire ideology off of being anti-enlightenment.
I guess,
you know, enlightenment. This is sort of, you know, bringing it a little bit full circle, but, you know, these guys hate the enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And the enlightenment was the political and social movement that delivered us basically from reactionary, horrible regimes where, you know, everybody was kind of stuck in place. You know, there was no such thing as social mobility, really. I mean, you could join the church, you know, that was your social mobility, and you could go be a priest. But if you were born a serf, you know, your place in society was a serf. And so whenever you eliminate the enlightenment and you say, oh, well, you know, it's just not giving us the spiritual fulfillment that we need, you know, they imagine themselves as the Lord. They don't imagine themselves being the serf. And
always,
I think, Curtis Yarvin is a interesting example because, well, actually, disregard that. I don't even think he's worth talking about. I think he's a self-promoter. But I think, you know, Asmongold, doesn't he kind of live in like a gross environment? Is that true?
He used to, but it's not worth attacking him over it because it's just a meme in his community now and nobody cares.
Oh, it's not actually. Well, I was just saying, I mean, I think, you know, the idea that the right-wing people want to tell everybody how to live. You know, it's a if it's true that the rat alarm clock is a real thing, it seems like maybe you're not in a position to tell people how they should be living.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they're the ultimate liberals who don't want to be judged for their lifestyle. Other times they're it just depends on what they're attacking or defending at any point in time.
Yeah. Yourself.
Final question. I think what is the I'll just inject. The scariest thing to me, have you seen the stories coming out of Fulton County?
saw a picture of Tulsi Gabbard with like a box of ballots or whatever.
Yeah, I feel like this is the scariest thing. People keep asking me, like, are we even going to have midterms? Are they going to rig it? And in my mind, they can't really because it's such a huge process. But like, if they were going to, this is the direction that they would have to take. This is what you'd be looking for.
Yeah, I have no idea what's going to come of that. Mm-hmm. I think you're right to be scared about it, though.
Yeah, well.
I think it's good that, I think people in Minneapolis have been giving us all a good example lately. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been getting out there in sub-zero temperatures to protest. So I think that may be what we all need to be thinking about doing soon.
Maybe, yeah. I hope, yeah.
I hope the Democratic Party is. I hope that the Democratic Party is willing to take some substantive steps to defend democracy with the power that they have.
Do you have big feelings on like upcoming shutdown? Like what Democrats should be asking for or demanding?
They should be asking for some concessions on DHS and ICE.
Like what?
I don't have a strong opinion on what that should be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd like to see them unmasked. I think that would make them behave in a less unaccountable, thuggish way. I'd like to see Kristi Noem fired. I'd like to see
one thing in terms of what you're saying. One thing that, because I try to observe the thought and think, like, am I mind right now by a conservative framing? And one thing I worry is, like, the things that you're asking for, I feel like I agree with what you're saying, but then I wonder, are these really negotiables? Like, I think Kristi Noem should have stepped down as soon as she was lied about the thing. I don't think that should be negotiated. I don't think we should have given anything. I don't think ICE agents, it's always the, can you imagine? But, like, can you imagine if Obama's FBI or if Obama's federal agents were masked going around arresting people? I feel like these are, you know, we're shutting down for, and then asking for things that should be no-brainers. Yeah, it's so annoying. It's so frustrating to me. Yeah, but I mean, I agree. I don't think, obviously, we can't push too far, but yeah.
It's hard to say exactly, but you know, frankly, if the Republicans want to run the government without Democrats, they have that power. You know, they don't need 60 votes. The filibuster is something that they could eliminate at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, on some level, I think that the Democrats feel this sort of noblesse oblige to help the Republicans through their own suffering and help them figure out a compromise that keeps the government broadly functional. But I mean, I'm not a legislative strategist. And so I hope that they come up with some achievable shutdown demand, mm-hmm. you know, whatever that ends up being. I do think that they should probably shut the government down. I think that would be a good thing to do. A thing that people often get confused about whenever you hear people say law and order all the time, right?
Yeah.
I really don't know how much law itself plays into the law and order mindset. I think order is much more important.
And by order, you mean like the way that they see society as ordered, right? Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like whenever you see cops, you know, I say cops, what I mean is the DHS personnel mm-hmm. invading cities, whenever you see chaos in the government, whenever you see inability to run a government, that doesn't come off as ordered. It comes off as disorder. And so while the Trump administration might perceive themselves as, you know, enforcing the law, I think from a practical political perspective, they're actually getting it wrong. People don't see the kind of thing that they're doing in Minneapolis as law and order. They see it as disorder. So I don't know. Far be it from me to tell the Democrats in the Senate, you know, exactly what they should do, but I do think they should probably shut the government down.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, any other thoughts?
No. I think that was a fun conversation. Fun conversation. I'm Ryan Getty, for those of you who don't know me.
Cool. What's your background?
I used to work as a lobbyist, and then before that I was a legislative aide in the Texas House of Representatives, and then before that I was in college.
Cool. Did you graduate like a poli sci degree or something, or?
Yeah, my actual degree is in government, which is just what they called it at UT, but it's political science, and then my minor was in history.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for the chat. If you ever want to hop on and chat about anything, just let me know. I can give you permissions from if you want to jump in if you hear anything going on, but yeah. Sure. Who's like your person, if you could talk to anybody in politics right now, who would you want to chat with?
I'd really like to talk to Jamel Bowie. I sent him an email a while back, but I'm a little bit small potatoes for him, I think. Mm-hmm. I really would like to talk to him though. He's someone that I've really, that's why I knew whenever you mentioned his video, because mm-hmm. I've liked him for a long time.
Cool. Okay. Well, hey, yep. Good luck with everything. And yeah, message me if there's ever anything comes up, and I'll chat with you in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds good. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks a lot. Bye.